Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event, The Great Debate on China. And thank you very much for spending some of your time with us here this evening. And I'm very pleased to say that I have my guests with me, and I'm going to introduce them now. And to do that, I have to do a couple of button pushes. Firstly, I push the sound on so that we can hear them. And then if I press the button, Robbie, hello, you're up first. Welcome.
Well, thanks, Martin.
How are you doing? All right?
Yeah, this is, I'm in the heart of the leper colony of Australia, as I complained about last time. We're even more quarantined now, but doing okay.
Great. And you've got a strategically placed plant there for art's sake. Very impressive.
Yes. Bit of green.
Great. Salvatore, how are you doing?
Good. Good to meet Robbie virtually. Great to talk to everyone on YouTube.
It's terrific to have you both here. And just to explain to everybody that we essentially have the facilities to be able to show both of us together. And whoever is talking from Salvatore or Robbie will actually have the Zoom feed. So basically, whoever shouts loudest gets on.
Yeah, can we zoom over you, Martin?
No. I'm actually controlling the views, so I can lose you like that, right? And there you go, you've disappeared. People can still hear you, but hopefully that's all good. So, all right, now we're all ready to run. So just to sort of set this up a little bit, what I just wanted to say is that I want this to be hopefully a really informed but also entertaining debate about China, because China is such a critical part of the discussion of Australia and more broadly. And of course, there'll be many different views and many different perspectives, and I'm going to pick some of those up in the chat as we go forward. But what I thought we'd perhaps do is just get a little bit of input from each of the two proponents and do two things. One is I'll let you just introduce yourself, because people might not know you, and then secondly, just a little bit of what are the key notes that you want to make sure that we cover tonight, and you know, what are the key thoughts with regard to China, Australia, and broadly. Salvatore, can I come to you first?
Sure. I'm Salvatore Bobonis. I'm an associate professor at the University of Sydney. And according to my website, I'm Australia's globalization expert. So take that for what you will. As you can hear from my voice, I am an American. I've been in Australia since 2008. I'm a permanent resident here, but I am an American citizen. That said, I'm not speaking tonight for the United States. I think a lot of people make the mistake in international relations debates of pretending that they're speaking for their country, and I'm not here to speak for the United States, but I am an American, and I do broadly share an American worldview with most of my compatriots. And I have to say, from that perspective, it strikes me that Australia, more than any other Western country, has been deeply infiltrated by China. And that goes well beyond politicians and the elite. In the United Kingdom, there's been a real infiltration of the British elite by China, Chinese firms and the Chinese government simply putting British politicians on the payroll. It's kind of embarrassing and disgusting at the same time in the UK. But I think in the UK, that pretty much stops at the level of elite politicians. Or if it doesn't stop there, at least it comes to a break there. In Australia, I think it goes much deeper, because so many Australians, especially Australians in positions of authority, have themselves bought into the Chinese collaboration and Chinese point of view, whether that's mining magnates who are intensely self-interested to the tune of billions of dollars in taking China's stance on every issue you can imagine, whether it's universities that self-censor and do backflips with policy in order not to offend China, which is a source of, in some cases, more than one quarter of their total tuition revenue. We see it in the world of real estate and development, where developers know very well that the future prosperity of real estate development in China depends on getting more and more Chinese immigrants into their developments, buying their units and their houses that they're putting up for sale. We see it even in, and forgive me, there are always accusations of racism that flip, just get thrown at this topic, new citizens. Now, of course, anyone who Australia accepts into its civic community as a citizen of Australia is a citizen of Australia with a right to you know, her or his own point of view. But when a country accepts so many new citizens from another country that is potentially a rival, that is strongly at odds with its own values and point of view, inevitably Australia gets lots of new citizens. And here I'm not talking about Chinese Australians who've been in Australia for generations. I'm talking about new Australian citizens who frankly only came to Australia and got citizenship to collect a better passport and to smuggle money or their families out of China. And many of them share the Chinese government's point of view and are entirely, you know, online with the Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party. They may be party members themselves. There's nothing to prevent Communist Party members from becoming citizens of Australia. And when that happens, of course, the infection is in the house. There's not much you can do about it because people who are legitimately, legally, you know, Australian citizens now have a voice that is fundamentally the voice of the Chinese Communist Party. Australia, in short, has an internal constituency from China, which is different from the mere foreign influence. I mean, if you speak for a foreign country in Australia, you have to register as an agent of foreign influence. But if you just happen to share the points of view that the Chinese government has as its talking points, well, that's perfectly legitimate in a democracy. And I think that becomes dangerous for a country like Australia.
Thanks, Salvatore. Very interesting. And Robbie, over to you. I'm sure you'll have a introduction to yourself, but also some perspectives in terms of the things that you want to talk about and your argument. Oh. Go, Robbie.
All right. So I'm Robbie Barwick from the Citizens Party. I'm the research director, and our party is very keen on the economic development of Australia, which is one of the points of interest in looking at the China question. We're also very keen on peace, though, which is another point of interest. Like Salvatore, I'm not going to pretend to speak on behalf of Australia because, unfortunately, public opinion in Australia has been well and truly turned in recent years to Salvatore's position. Which to me is alarming, but I want to express my view of China by first reflecting on the United States, but in a good way, and because there is a lot of good about the United States, and this is not specific to your nationality, Salvatore. It's just that I would want to start this conversation anyway, because the main reason I feel we're having this conversation in the terms we're having it is because of the decisions being made largely in the United States, not entirely. I mean, Australia's contributing to them, but it's a view that's been set up by a sense of United States-China rivalry that then defines what is happening here in Australia. The United States Republic is a great nation, and it was founded on the very highest ideals. It's the model of modern nation states. And it truly was a beacon of hope and a temple of liberty for the world. The original idea of American exceptionalism was that America was unique among a world of empires, and it absolutely was. But the founding fathers of the United States, who created this great republic, rejected the idea that America should impose its system on the world. And I just want to read a quote from John Quincy Adams, 1821. He said, "Wherever the standard of freedom and independence has been or shall be unfurled, there will be her heart, her benedictions, and her prayers. But she," that is the United States, "goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own." Now, I think it's tragic, and recent history bears this out, that America now emulates the British Empire and goes forth seeking monsters to destroy. And because it has that intention, the evidence shows over the last 20 years, if it can't find monsters, it creates them. And the monster now is China. And it's been a sudden shift in the last decade that China went from being this country that was impressively growing to suddenly the number one threat in everybody's mind. Yes, China is a different country. Yes, it's a communist country. Yes, it's an authoritarian country. But it does not warrant the extreme demonization that it's received from factions, political factions in the United States, in Australia, in Britain, especially in the media. It's a nation that has shown it has an ability to change. It has an ability to learn from its mistakes, and quite dramatically so. It has shown by its results that it actually is motivated by the common good of its citizens, and you can see that in the performance of its economy. That motivation has made China the most successful economy in the world in the last 40 years. By some measurements, in terms of how quickly it's lifted people out of poverty, it's the most successful economy in the history of the world. The success, this is to me a key point, the success has come from partly a desire to learn from other countries, right? You know, learn the positives from other countries. So China explicitly looked for economic examples that worked, which it could apply, and it took those examples from countries like Japan, like the United States, like Australia, and it applied them well. The irony is, though, the policies that China adopted that made it such a success, it adopted them at a time when our own countries abandoned those kind of policies. We embraced neoliberalism instead, and we embraced it in a very ideological way. Right, we defined anything that wasn't neoliberalism, i.e. the many previous decades of our own economic histories, as virtually communism, which was always bizarre and ridiculous. So we went down this path, a certain path. China did what we used to do, which was, yes, allow a free market, but also have public investment to help shape where that was going, right? And it's worked spectacularly, while ours, frankly, in my view, has failed. But instead of acknowledging that success, we've had this sudden shift, and I regard it as a sudden shift, in especially the United States, but also the UK and Australia has followed along with it, among this neoconservative faction who want to demonize China's economic success as a threat. You can't really demonize China's military as a threat because America is so much of a bigger military force than anywhere else in the world combined. But suddenly this economic success is a threat. And I argue that it's not. China is not trying to upend the world order. It values stability, but it also wants its sovereignty respected. I regard it as pretty bizarre that we keep we so loosely accuse it of foreign interference, where it's the one country in the world that is the most strict in terms of guarding the principle of non-interference. It's one of its foundations. It wants to have a say, though, in global governance, in global bodies that's commensurate with its position now, and I think that's understandable, and that creates a bit of a tension, but it shouldn't create the amount of tension it does. The Belt and Road Initiative, which is the most demonised part about China at the moment, it's supposedly the proof of China's global expansion, is an infrastructure offer. It's China's offer to the world, say, this is what worked for us, we would like to do it with you. And to me, its sign of good faith was that it offered the world, you can all participate. It even invited the United States to participate. The US could be in there with China, shaping the projects, helping build infrastructure and economic development. Instead, it's sniping from the sidelines. And so Australia has become defined suddenly by this American reaction to China's success that a political faction here has bought into. And it's happening to the detriment of our economy because, yes, we are very dependent on China. In theory, we're too dependent on China in the sense you shouldn't be so dependent on any one country. But as I've often said, we're very, very lucky it's China we're dependent on because it does real things and for that reason keeps consuming our goods that we're happy to send it in terms of raw materials. So that's at risk. But more importantly, world peace is now at risk because of the reactionary setup and escalating tensions that's happening, which I argue China didn't initiate, the Anglo-American powers did.
Okay, Robbie, thank you for that. Both went over 5 minutes, but that's okay. Let me just come back to myself for a second. So there's a lot of there on both sides. What I want to try and do is to now slice the conversation into some of the dimensions that we've touched on. And I guess the first point I want to go on is the question about can you separate the political from the economic? And there was this very interesting piece of data that came up the other day that China has 48.8% of Australia's exports. So in other words, nearly half of all the things that we sell around the world, we sell to China. And that then suggests that we have a very significant, in fact, almost deadly embrace between China and ourselves with regard to the economics. And so the question is, can we continue to do that, given the fact that we've got also a political set of issues? Robbie, you've highlighted those quite significantly. Salvatore, can I come back to you first? Can we separate the political from the economic? What do you think?
Well, you can't separate them where China is concerned, and you also can't separate them where the United States is concerned. Both are geoeconomic powers that use their economic dominance to further political ends. That said, I don't think that 48% of exports figure is particularly scary. Australia's exports are, let's face it, primarily minerals, digging stuff out of the ground. And those minerals are sold into a global market. They are fundamentally fungible. Now, I know that's not entirely true. I know that certain grades of coal are better suited for certain power plants, this sort of thing. But basically, when it comes down to it, if China doesn't buy Australian iron ore, it has to buy Brazilian iron ore. And if China buys Brazil's iron ore, then Australia's iron ore goes to whoever Brazil was supplying. I mean, it's like saying that Saudi Arabia was dependent on the United States in the 1970s because it was exporting half of its oil to the United States. Well, did that make Saudi Arabia dependent, or did it make the United States dependent? And the answer is it's complicated, right? There's not any close connection there. Now, the place where Australia has shown itself very dependent has been in higher education exports, which are only a small portion of Australia's total exports, but those are structurally linked to China in a way that minerals exports are not.
Okay, very interesting. Thanks. Robbie, where do you sit on the political versus economic?
Well, I think that, we're quite dependent. We're certainly dependent in higher education. We're dependent in tourism. But I don't see any evidence, because I have learned not to believe the way the media characterise it, that economic dependence has come with any undue political influence. What happens is, There's a normal relationship that comes with that economic relationship. It's entirely normal. Australians who do business in China want to have good relations with China. Chinese who do business in Australia want to have good relations in Australia. It's just that what from any other country would be considered normal business relations and normal way of doing conducting international affairs. In a friendly manner, I mean, by definition, trying to influence each other, that's what happens in business, in any kind of economic relationship. When it comes from China, it gets twisted as, oh, this is some kind of sinister attempt to take us over. What we've seen in the last few months, where the politics and the trade have become mixed, has happened in a couple of examples where we have quite blatantly stood in lockstep with the United States on some pretty dodgy issues, in my view. And China has naturally had a reaction to that because they lose any respect for Australia acting in its own independent foreign interest. And we're seen to be so obviously just parroting the line out of the White House. And then trade has become an issue.
Before we get too far away from iron ore, though, I mean, let me say something that will, I think, prompt Robbie into a response, which is that if we should think about that export number at all, we should think of it more in terms of should Australia be selling to China than is Australia dependent on China. So let me go back to World War II, when Sweden supplied the German war machine with iron ore. And Sweden became complicit in the crimes of the Nazi regime. Now, of course, Swedes don't see it that way, and there's a lot of historical debate on this, but I certainly see it that way. Now, depending on how evil you think the Chinese regime is, and I'm starting to think quite evil, supplying China with the raw materials for its increasing militarization of the world, I view as troubling. Now, I'm going to invite Robbie to take a different viewpoint on that.
Well, sorry, Salvatore, a country with 800 military bases around the world that outspends the next 10 countries in the world combined, including China and Russia, on military, that's got 40 aircraft carriers to two of China, right, cannot accuse China of building...
ground rules. I'm not the United States. So I'm not the United States accusing China of something. I'm talking about China.
Fine. But you raised it. You made the comparison to Nazi Germany. They're not building a war machine. They've built 35,000 kilometers of high-speed rail in 10 years using our iron ore. So their people, 1.4 billion people, can travel around at a higher living standard. That is not a war machine. That is a positive thing. And it's just this is the kind of spin that I find outrageous, but it's what passes for accepted commentary nowadays, and it's just not backed up by the facts.
There is the militarization of the South China Sea.
They've created sandbars and put a few installations on there. That the what's actually on those installations is nothing compared to the firepower of the carrier groups that sail through there. United States carrier groups puts them in the shade compared to that amount of firepower. But can I also say that militarization of the South China Sea happened after, in 2012, I mean, think of it from China's standpoint, but also North Korea's, also other countries. Think of it from their standpoint. Here's the United States spends from 2001 to 2012 committing two regime change wars, unleashing untold misery across the United States and North Africa, both in extremely dodgy ways in terms of international law, the first one on a blatant lie, the second one by actually making false promises to members of the UN Security Council. And then after stuffing up that part of the world and showing that America and its British allies do not regard themselves as very well constrained by international law, then Obama says, we're going to pivot to Asia. And they deploy 60% of America's military to this part of the world, including Marines in Darwin. China responded with the islands after that. In other words, what China did was a reaction to America saying, we have the right to go in and we're going to start constraining you.
Right? So this is, as I understand it, the Great China debate, not the Great America debate, though I'm very happy to have the Great America debate. I don't want to be led too far down that direction. What I'm asking Australians, and I'm assuming that our audience is mainly Australians, is this a regime you want to be doing business with? Now, you may ask them, is America a regime you want to do business with? And that's a legitimate question. We could discuss that as well if Martin wants to lead the discussion in that direction. But my question is, and the China debate question is this a regime that Australia wants to do business with?
Well, I'd ask Martin to put up the number 8 graphic, foreign investment in Australia. So which is the regime we actually do business with? So that quite clearly shows the regime that owns us in Australia, whereas most viewers here of this debate would be under the impression that China owns us. No, the United States, the United Kingdom, even Belgium way out does that. And then Martin, if you put up the number 11 graphic, these are the same 10 countries. The same 10 countries, our top 10 export customers, and this is a trade balance we have with them. And the regime you're talking about earns us a lot of money, but because you're right, we're exporting raw materials, but it does a lot of real things with those raw materials. Whereas no other economy that we do business with can compare.
And yeah, like I said, I'm happy, you know, if Martin wants to have the Great America debate, I'm happy to have round two about whether Australia should or shouldn't be doing business with the United States. That's a question I think most Australians will feel that it's perfectly acceptable to do business with the United States. I think most Australians probably are very comfortable using Google. They may hate Microsoft like I do, but they don't worry too much about using Microsoft. They watch YouTube. I think most Australians probably have more reservations about TikTok, about WeChat.
Why is China suddenly a country that we have reservations about doing business with?
I think Australia is waking up to China. If you asked me a year ago, I would have said, It's amazing that Australia does not have reservations about doing business with China. And I think that's changed dramatically in a year.
Salvatore, China's pretty much the biggest trading partner of every country in the world.
Yeah.
So this is not a unique question for Australia. The whole world does business with China. Why is it suddenly an issue?
The revelations about the concentration camps in northwest China, China's aggression on the India-China frontier, China's militarization of the South China Sea, the ramming of fishing boats in off the coasts of Japan, the Philippines, and Indonesia. China's stated threats to start wars. I mean, the rhetoric that comes out of the Global Times, which is a party newspaper in China, is scary.
I've watched Fox News too.
Fox News is not an official outlet of the United States.
I've watched Sky News.
Tell me about Voice of America if you want to talk about official American communications.
Well, okay.
Sky News is a private channel.
Voice of America, Radio Free Asia. These sort of outlets that have taken up issues like the Uyghurs, which I think is there's lots of evidence that it's completely overblown, totally exaggerated. The claims are made from a handful of American influenced sources, and they have as much credibility so far as weapons of mass destruction. And the reason that I think, if I can give the audience a grounding in when they hear about the Uyghur Muslims issue, what you never hear is about the 800 Chinese people killed in dozens and dozens of terrorist attacks in the 10 years before China commenced its de-radicalization program there. That's never mentioned. In other words, there's a context of what it's done, but what it's done is not concentration camps. It's not genocide. It's done it in a Chinese way, right? But it was dealing with a very fundamentally real problem, which one of the things that China has to contend with that Australia or America don't have to contend with is that China does not have agencies in the Chinese government dedicated to the overthrow of the Australian government or dedicated to the overthrow of the United States government. But the United States government, the British government, etc., have agencies dedicated to the overthrow of the Chinese government. And those agencies work with any kind of separatists, any kind of disaffected groups, etc., to try and do that. And of course, China is naturally going to defend itself. So I'm not going to defend everything, every particular method, but I do know the quality of the accusations thrown against China, from everything I've seen, are no more credible. But they're just as they're presented just as forcefully as were weapons of mass destruction. And if you want to look at what we accuse China of potentially being compared with what actually has happened, documented in the world in the last 20 years by one or two regimes that are Australia's closest allies, there's no comparison. China does not have the blood on its hands that the British and the Americans do over Iraq and Libya.
Okay, let me come in there. And clearly, we knew this was going to be an interesting debate and high voltage, and that's good. I'm not watching the chat. But one of the questions I've got for you both is, given that there are clearly some considerable issues with regards to the direction that China's taking and the direction that the US is taking, and clearly Australia has a foot in both camps, economic or whatever, the question is it feasible for Australia to effectively stand, with a foot in each camp, or are we effectively seeing the two parts moving away, and effectively are we basically being pulled in two directions, and is that therefore a sustainable or non-sustainable outcome? Robbie, what do you think about that?
Well, I think the expression foot in both camps is probably the wrong way to think about it. I think Australia should aspire to be far more independent in its dealings with both countries. And if it did that, it could speak truth to power in the United States much more forcefully. And it would also be more credible when it did choose to speak directly with China. At the moment, it's lost its independence. And I'm not the only one who thinks this way. some of my perspective on this it's very similar to what the late Malcolm Fraser, former Prime Minister, used to express, and he wrote a book about it called Dangerous Allies. And in his argument in that book was Australia's never been and never had independent foreign policy. For the first, until World War II, our foreign policy was British. After World War II, we made a sovereign decision to embrace the United States, and that was the best thing we ever did. That was excellent. But then increasingly there was this encroachment where we just thought we had to go along with everything the United States did, and we didn't do it in any kind of independent way. It was no one thought about it because of the context of the Cold War. But Malcolm Fraser was the war minister in Vietnam, right? He was prime minister during the Cold War. He overlapped the Reagan administration, etc. He was there at the height of the Cold War, and he was able to reflect on this later on. Partly because he saw how bad the Iraq experience turned out, and he fought very hard to try and stop that. And he spent his final few years saying, look, Australia must become an independent country. And as an independent country, we would want to keep our relationship with both of them. My feeling is America puts more conditions on the relationship than China does. It's just that China is like, well, if you don't like our business, we'll take it elsewhere. And then we react to that. But we do not seem to be game to buck the United States and the British when it comes to these big foreign policy decisions. And Iraq was an example of that. So if we were more independent, we could manage the relationship much, much better. I would not try and think of it in negative terms, think of it in positive terms. We could help appeal to the United States in a situation where, like now, where you have this rather, you know, strange White House where the president has expressed instincts of establishing better relations with countries like China. Despite his rhetoric, we've learned to look past his rhetoric. He would be prepared to do deals, but his administration is full of people that just seem to want a war, right? That they're driven by a total motivation to do that. We could appeal to their better nature and say, there's a better way to deal with this. And that's what I would recommend.
Salvatore.
Frankly, I found all the talk about a foot in both camps that was, I think, prevalent in Australian foreign policy discussions a year and a quarter ago, maybe up until last June 2019, I found that really alarming. And frankly, I'm really relieved to see that rhetoric has now mostly evaporated, as I think the China threat has become much clearer over the last 12 months, and especially over the last, since the beginning of the coronavirus epidemic. The fact is that Australia, practically speaking, can run an independent foreign policy with 198 countries of the world, and there are only two countries in the world with which Australia really has to make decisions about taking sides, and that's with the United States and China. Practically speaking, Australia can run an independent foreign policy vis-a-vis Singapore, vis-a-vis the European Union, vis-a-vis the United Kingdom, Canada, and there's really no problem with that. But let's say Australia were to decide that it believes in freedom of navigation and were to run a freedom of navigation patrol in the South China Sea. Well, it does not have the capacity to do that. Let's say an Australian were put in prison in China, as two Canadians have been, and I'm sure we'll get to the Huawei Canadian issue as something we can really get our teeth into in a few minutes. Well, again, what can Australia do? Not much. Now, that also applies the other way. If you do want to talk about the Great America debate, can Australia stand up to U.S. pressure on trademarks and copyrights? Well, not really. I mean, Australia has had to accede to U.S. policies on trademarks and copyrights because not to do so would have locked it out of too much of the world economy. There are two countries with which Australia really doesn't have the resources to run an independent foreign policy. And ultimately, I think Australians have to decide which country they're more comfortable with.
Yeah, but you define an act of independence as something that I think is totally bizarre. We practice freedom of navigation through the South China Sea more than any other country because we send more iron ore through the South China Sea more than any other country. It's never been threatened. Why? Because it's trade with China. It's not a threat. Our trade is with China. China is not a threat to its own trade. We prove the freedom of navigation in the South China Sea every day. Yet you're saying that, the United States comes along and says, no, no, we want you to sail within the 12 nautical mile zone around these installations, because we want to provoke China over those installations. And Australia, one of the few times Australia says, well, we don't see the need to do that, because they do not have any bearing on freedom of navigation through the South China Sea, is regarded as not being independent in foreign policy. And I just completely reject that.
I actually don't think Australia should run freedom of navigation operations, but I think it's disingenuous to claim that Australia does currently run freedom of navigation operations. Australia does not assert the principles of international law in the South China Sea. Australia is reluctant to call out China's genocide. Australia, I think, would have difficulty supporting the Tibetan government in exile if it chose to. I mean, Australia may choose not to upset China, just as Australia chooses not to upset the United States. I think there are really two countries in the world with which Australia can't fully take any position it legitimately wants to. And Australians, I think, have to decide. I mean, I'm not the one telling Australians to choose. I think, practically speaking, you know, just like with the UK, to depersonalize it a little bit, the UK had to make a decision, either take cheaper Huawei equipment or get out of the intelligence sharing game. Well, it had to choose. That's a practical fact of international life. Now, it may be wrong and unfair that it has to choose, but it is a practical fact that it has to choose.
No, but again, it's had to choose over something that was a non-issue that was turned into an issue. If GCHQ, the most sophisticated intercept organization in the world, was happy to have a lab there to check all Huawei equipment and vet it before it could be used to take away any sense that any boogeyman, there could be something lurking in there, and that wasn't good enough because the administration in the White House says, no, we want to ban this, And in this particular case, using Australia as the example, Australia provided the evidence that Huawei was some kind of a threat. Yet in Malcolm Turnbull's own book, his biography admits there was no evidence that Huawei was a threat. They based this on a future wargaming scenario, right? Mm-hmm. And Huawei was regarded as a threat purely because it was Chinese.
Yeah, the GCHQ lab raised serious objections about Huawei. It was the political establishment in the UK that pushed through the decision anyway. But that's beside the point. I freely admit that the United States
corporations didn't find anything in Huawei equipment.
I will have to go to the reports on that, and we can't do that in a debate. So anyone who wants to hear our evidence can email both of us, and I'm happy to send out links. But I freely admit that Australia I claim that Australia does have to choose. And if you think Australia doesn't have to choose, I think your own testimony suggests that the United States is forcing Australia to choose. Now, you may think that's wrong of the United States to do, but the fact remains that Australia does have to make choices.
The United States is forcing us to choose. All China can do is say, do you want to do business with us?
Right.
Right? There's not much more to it than right. that. Now, China is not the country that made us so dependent on China. One of the things that gets up my nose with the Australian politicians who made us so dependent on China because of their mad embrace of neoliberalism and free trade, are now the ones that are trying to mostly right. demonize China and the Liberal Party, when Donald Trump or when Australian politicians use language such as China raped our economy, right? No, the businesses here that outsourced to China did that, not China. They were happy to take the industry, but we have become dependent on China. But and the Chinese say, well, do you want to do business with us or not?
Yeah.
Right. And if we don't want to do business, fine. But there's going to be consequences to that.
So if it's inevitable, let's have the Great America debate. So when the United States says we force you to choose, when the United States says it forces you to choose, what that means is no intelligence sharing, no security guarantee, no interoperability, no access to buying F-35 fighters if you don't choose to be part of that alliance. The Chinese side says, if you don't do what China wants, we will prohibit our tourists from coming to your country. We'll tell our students not to come to your country. We will impound your beef at our customs barriers. We'll shift to buying iron ore or coal somewhere else. Now, those kind of threats don't come from ordinary countries. I mean, no free country in the world is using threats of that kind. Now, withholding cooperation, yes, you know, the United States has its own self-interest, and it will withhold cooperation if it feels that that cooperation is, you know, puts the United States at risk. But the United States is not going to threaten to blockade Australia if Australia doesn't stay in a U.S. alliance. In fact, the only threat from the U.S. to Australia dropping the U.S. alliance is that if Australia drops the U.S. alliance, the United States will drop Australia from the alliance, which seems fair enough, if you ask me.
Salvatore, you opened by talking about the number of new Australians who are Chinese. You sort of echoed the Clive Hamilton line that we should be suspicious of their loyalty. This has become part of the accepted conversation in Australia now. It's McCarthyism on steroids. It's making the Chinese feel extremely unwelcome. And all the Chinese ambassador said when we had a bizarre week where Mike Pompeo made all kinds of allegations about China and coronavirus, only after America's performance on coronavirus was so miserable, so pathetic, then he lashed out at China to deflect the blame. And the worst China hawks in the Australian media were on Insiders on a Sunday morning, Peter Harcher and a few others, Greg Sheridan, and set up the foreign minister, who blurted out, oh, yeah, there should be some inquiry, right? And then that took on a life of its own, and Malcolm, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, doubled down on that after a conversation with Donald Trump. Yes, we want to have an inquiry. Totally echoing the United States, the Chinese ambassador said, "If with this kind of unfriendliness from your country," now, put aside whether you think the inquiry was reasonable. It was the context in which it came up. With this kind of unfriendliness in your country, where we're accused of being spies, everyone here is some kind of an infiltrator. Chinese people are being bashed in the streets over coronavirus, and they are, and they were, right? He said people are not going to be very keen to send their kids to study here, etc. The particular trade issues, I mean, you've got to put them in context that China took one anti-dumping measure on the barley after Australia has taken 117 or something on steel and other measures. China has never done an anti-dumping measure before, and this was something that was set in train actually many, many months earlier. It just came to a head that week, right? China has had a genuine issue with beef labelling. There's a lot of meat substitution fraud in China. A genuine issue with beef labelling. In fact, I think at least one of those companies that it temporarily stopped is a Chinese-owned company anyway. Genuine issue with beef labelling. And the way China seems to do business, it's willing to cut you some slack if there's good relations, right? Make some allowances, etc. But if it runs out of patience, it runs out of patience. But there's a context there. But the real issue was when our foreign policy establishment was so quick to help the Trump administration deflect the blame for coronavirus entirely onto China, right? And the Brits were trying to do exactly the same thing. And you got this crowd like the Henry Jackson Society, which writes Andrew Hastings' speeches for them, the chief Wolverine in Parliament in Britain, demanding the decoupling from China, etc. And China's got to pay trillions of dollars in lawsuits over coronavirus, all this kind of stuff. Yet these are the people gunning for regime change in that country. And the Chinese, naturally reacted. And then we turn that reaction into proof of how bad they are.
Okay, let me just come in here because obviously we can go down onto one item, but I just want to sort of turn the conversation slightly differently. And that is the question that is coming through quite often in the chat here is, what about the, how much of Australia has China bought? And it's a question of land, it's a question of other assets, right? And there seems to be some quite different perspectives in terms of is China buying up everything or not? Now, Robbie, you showed some data, I think, earlier on that suggests that it's actually nowhere near as big as many think. But there still seems to be something that is very much in the consciousness of many Australians to say China is buying everything up here. Why do you think that is? Robbie, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I would love to go first. There's a word for it. It's called propaganda. And I want to cite a report. I think it's a very insightful report. I would encourage anyone interested in the subject in the world to read this report. It was a paper, written in 1988 by an American and a Russian academics, two academics. Jerome Frank from Johns Hopkins University is a psychologist. Andre Melville from the Academy of Sciences in the USSR, and it's called The Image of the Enemy and the Process of Change. And these two gentlemen got together at the end of the Cold War and wrote a very insightful paper about how so much of the Cold War was dependent on the level to which both countries demonized each other. Right? The demonization of each country was so important to how they were able to pursue the Cold War. And it was things like this. This was some of the things they pointed out. They said, it was often said that the people are good, it's only the leaders who are evil. And we're hearing that exactly now from the United States about China. They made this point, the enemy image is a self-fulfilling prophecy. In combating what each perceives to be the other's cruelty and treachery, each may become more cruel and treacherous itself, and I would say dishonest. All this can progress to the point where the enemy is perceived as literally demonic, that is totally evil. They made a positive point. I'll get to that in a minute. I just want to talk about the ownership question now. This is where I think the media, unfortunately, if I was a sincere Chinese communist cadre, or from any number of countries for that matter, I'm just China, and you're told that Western democracy is so great, and you look at how it's actually practiced in Western democracies, and the role that billionaire media moguls have in being able to freely shape public opinion without any accountability whatsoever, it would not, what you would say, why would we adopt that kind of system? Because this is an example of it. The media, with the help of a few politicians, but mainly the media, just with incessant headlines about Chinese ownership of Australia, have created something in the minds of the Australian people that's just not true. Now, the factors are, if you're someone who lives in a capital city, especially Melbourne or Sydney and likely Brisbane, I suppose, in this last 15, 20 years that you know so well, Martin, of the property bubble in Australia, yes, plenty of Chinese money was buying up that property big time, right? And you know that. So I'm not discounting that at all. That was real, right? Chinese money was flooding in here buying up that property. And Salvatore was right to identify the vested interests or the thinking that came into the property spruikers. Oh, yeah, we want this Chinese money. I remember, though, when we first looked at this in 2013, the percentage wasn't as big as of the actual sales that people might have thought, but nevertheless, it was definitely a factor on the ground. That did fall off, though, in the last few years, big time, because there was a large amount of it was money laundering, and that fell off, and the Australian authorities seemed to want that. Knowing it was laundered money, they seemed to want it anyway. They didn't care. They just wanted their property bubble up. But that amount of investment by individuals in houses is not really showing up, doesn't really show up in the figures per se. In the big foreign investment figures, the ones that get the real headlines, it's way overblown. And the two are the ones I've just shown, which is the foreign investment figures. But can you put up the number 10, the farm ownership figures? I just want to explain this. This is worth this looking at. So the one area China does seem to rank as an investor is in the ownership of farmland. And this is very emotional to people. It's more emotional than most things that China buys. So the one on the left, of course, just the colour ones slice of the pie. That's how much of Australia's farmland is owned by foreign investors totally. And Britain is the purple and China is the red. And then that's, you go to the next one there on the right, and that slice of the pie is now its own pie chart. And so you see, slightly out of date now, I think they're probably, on paper, they rank with each other. But just look at the Chinese slice of the pie there. So 9.2 million hectares of Australia, China owns, and it might be about 10 now. What you don't know from looking at that, that's the landmark figures, the headline figures, is how that is calculated. And in the case of China, 87% of that slice of the pie, 87% is one asset. And that one asset is a beef company, a very large Australian beef company, in which China, a Chinese owner, has a one-third stake. It's Gina Rinehart's beef company. So 87% of all Chinese ownership of land in Australia, 87% is attributed to China based on its one-third stake in Gina Rinehart's very, very large beef company. And that's called Chinese Investment in Australian Land. So even in land, China is nowhere near as big as the United Kingdom, right, and is much more in the same size as the United States and Netherlands, etc. So,
okay, Robbie, let's
just don't bear it out.
Yeah, okay. So what now, you're saying is that basically the perspective is wrong. Salvatore, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think it's a matter of how much. I think it's a matter of what character. Everyone, I think, is comfortable with the idea that if an American firm invests in agricultural land in Australia, it's to run a farm to make money. It's for purely commercial reasons. When a Chinese firm does the same, well, maybe it's for commercial reasons. Maybe it's to strip the technology. Maybe it's to strip the land itself. Maybe it's to, you know, and the list goes on and on, because that Chinese firm does not have purely commercial objectives. The Chinese firm is always at the beck and call of the state. Often it's a state-owned firm. But even if it's not a state-owned firm, of course, it's a firm that is operating in many ways on behalf of the state. There's no such thing as true private industry in China. Now, perhaps there was in the early 2000s, but since the Xi Jinping era began, there hasn't been. Now, I don't think that's a reason not to have any Chinese investment in Australia. I often point to the amusing fact that the top pork producer in the United States, Smithfield Farms, is Chinese owned. And in fact, when China put tariffs, to retaliatory tariffs on American pork, I laughed because the company they're putting tariffs on is a Chinese company that's exporting American pork to China. And that's the way the global economy works. So, you know, I'm not saying that Australia should prohibit Chinese investment. I'm just saying Australia is right to be circumspect about it. I mean, to get away from the land issue and to think about Chinese investment more broadly, the lease of the Port of Darwin to the Chinese state port operator, I think, was irresponsible of the Northern Territory. I mean, it's just not the sort of thing you should do with a key piece of infrastructure like a port. Now, I don't have any evidence of criminal behavior on the part of the Chinese port operator. Chinese port operators are the most efficient in the world. They've turned around Piraeus in Greece from the, you know, worst run, most loss-making port in Europe to one of the top ports in Europe. They can do good things. They can do good business. But in the back of your mind, that's always the question, are they truly there for commercial reasons, or are they there acting on behalf of a foreign government? And that's not a question you have with British or American or other investors who, for the most part, are just there to make a buck.
Who says that's not a question you have? I could sit here and easily cast the same insinuations on American investment you just did. You have no evidence for anything you just said. It's a feeling you have because of perspective you have on China. China for
yes,
some
absolutely.
Reason, yeah, but yeah.
Guilty as charged.
Why should the world be run that way? This is McCarthyism on steroids. This is garbage. No. I represent a party that would never have sold these assets in the first place. Right? It's near the neoliberalism is crazy, but to say that the country that is just has done nothing to Australia except be our best customer and a damn good one, right? Should be viewed with suspicion because America says so.
China is a party state run by a profoundly illiberal regime that, by your own admission, is intent on overturning a world order that you and they may feel is unfair to China. It is unfair to China, but they are certainly intent on, well, you said that they are intent on securing a greater voice in the world order. That is, they want it to reflect China's interests more than it does. Now, that may be a legitimate desire, but is that desire in Australia's interests? That's a different question.
Well, you just have to weigh it up against what Australia has made out of China, right? Is China a good customer? Do they do good business with us? Why? But also Australia has to be a mature player on the world stage. And sorry, but if countries like China and India, in fact, represent such big economies, and a country like India is not even on something like the UN Security Council. You've got some colonial overhangs of Britain and France on there, but not a country like India. Countries like China do not have a say commensurate to their size and their contribution to the world economy on some of these other forums. Then it is a legitimate question to ask that, you know, they make.
I strongly suspect that a democratic China with rule of law and, you know, good respect for civil liberties would be respected by the rest of the world and would be included in these forums. I think it would be instantly in the G7.
I can assure you it wouldn't. And here's why. In 1992, Paul Wolfowitz, as the Undersecretary of Defense, on behalf of Dick Cheney, espoused the Wolfowitz Doctrine, that America would not countenance the rise of any rival economic or military power. Doesn't matter what ideology they're from. America would not countenance a world that was in which America was not a sole superpower. And that was, at the time this was expressed, the current Democratic presidential candidate, Joe Biden, attacked that thinking and called it Pax America, a Pax Americana. We are not an American empire. Since then, Joe Biden and the rest of them have become these liberal interventionists that have seemingly embraced that even more, as just as crazily as the neocons. And one of the outspoken younger U.S. senators now, Josh Hawley, just the other day from Missouri, I think. I tend to follow some of these people on Twitter, and one of his aides expressed it on Twitter, this very thought in regard to India. And he made the point that if India was as much as powerful economically as China is now, with a military to match, America would also have a problem with India.
Yeah, Paul Wolfowitz and the senator are welcome to their viewpoints. I think that it would be very difficult to politically for anyone in the United States to exclude a liberal democratic China from participation in global governance. And I think the proof is in the pudding that when China was moving towards greater liberalization in the 1990s and early 2000s, it was very difficult to prevent, you know, American or other Western companies from investing heavily in China. I mean, even Google, which is prohibited from China, need I mention, has a large artificial intelligence research center just outside Beijing because they felt it was liberalizing, it's opening, it's an opportunity. But once China under Xi Jinping started going down this, I think, really scary path that it's been on for the last 3 or 4 years, well, those companies have now started to get cold feet and they're pulling out of China precisely because not turning into a liberal place to do business by, you know, its rule of law is diminishing. Executives are afraid that they'll get arrested in China and they'll be thrown in jail in solitary confinement and tortured until their company or their country gives in.
Which executives is that happening to?
Oh, I think they're afraid to do it. I mean, the guidance that I've heard you American companies be given is to not send their executives to China who could potentially be arrested. Of course, the Canadians we've seen already in jail in China as retribution for the jailing of Huawei's detaining of Huawei's chief financial officer. Canada put Huawei's chief financial officer in a well, extended house arrest. She's allowed to travel anywhere in Greater Vancouver. Meanwhile, China, on no obvious charges, has jailed two Canadians in solitary confinement and denied them consular access on the excuse of the threat of coronavirus. Now, you know, you be the judge. I think companies are saying we're afraid to do business in China.
Okay. Let me just come in there, guys, because what I want to do is just take the conversation slightly further forward. But what we're now getting to is the fundamental cultural norms, right? And we should therefore be thinking of perhaps things like what's going on in Hong Kong and some of the other issues as well. You know, there again seems to be some quite different views as to how the culture within China is working and how it's being manifest and what freedoms are being taken away or not being taken away. You know, and basically, is that good or is that bad? Because I think that the example of business is a subset of the broader culture issue. Salvador, do you want to come in first there in terms of the cultural norms, how you see them, and maybe specifically reference Hong Kong?
Well, China has the power and the authority to assert its will in Hong Kong. Of course, that doesn't mean that whether it's right or wrong, fair or unfair, that's a culturally situated decision. And of course, many people in Hong Kong are upset by it. Many people in China are in favor of it. Well, that's, you know, their own right to have a point of view. But if China does enforce a Chinese party state in Hong Kong and removes the liberties that Hong Kongers have traditionally enjoyed, it will find people fleeing Hong Kong. And I know at least one charitable foundation that's already fled Hong Kong. I know companies are all talking about getting out. My own cousin works for a public communications company. He's a partner in a public communications firm in Hong Kong, and they're talking about where they're going. Their clients are talking about where they're going because they were in Hong Kong precisely so they could be in a rule of law jurisdiction but still inside China. Well, China's decided that there won't be that rule of law jurisdiction anymore. Now companies are fleeing, whether it's to Singapore or Taipei or Tokyo or Seoul. That's just what's going to happen. Now, China has every right to do what it wants in its own territory, but that doesn't make it the morally correct thing to do, and it doesn't make it something we have to condone or participate in.
Well, the former public prosecutor, British public prosecutor of Hong Kong, whose name is Grenville something or other, it escapes me now, he would disagree with you about what you said about the rule of law. He's written an open letter to Boris Johnson expressing his disappointment at Boris Johnson's overreaction to not China's national security law. And he's British, he's the former public prosecutor of Hong Kong. He's the guy who oversaw the rule of law of Hong Kong, and he's disputing that the national security law is the shredding of the rule of law in Hong Kong. Ironically,
Chris Patten has taken the opposite point of view. Chris Patten, the former governor of Hong Kong, has taken exactly the opposite point of view. So there's opinions on both sides.
Sure, Chris Patten is the former governor who became governor when Hong Kong had no democracy, who introduced democracy at the 11th hour and 59th minute and 59th second as a poison pill to China. So for 150 years under British rule, zero democracy except right at the very end. And then when told China, you've got to, any change to this, we're going to accuse you of being undemocratic. Well, you know, I think the man who lives there, this former prosecutor, his view is far more valid. And ironically, it came about, it's not the shredding of the rule of law, it's the assertion of the rule of law, because it came about because China, Hong Kong had an extradition treaty with everyone else in the world except the country it belongs to. Hong Kong had an extradition with except China. And when someone could go and commit murder in Taiwan and get away with it because they're in Taiwan and was not allowed to be charged with murder back in Hong Kong, this naturally led to a reforming of the law as it would in any country. But the CIA, the National Endowment for Democracy, all the American groups that are there to stir up trouble, the US consulate got involved with those pro-democracy groups in China, in Hong Kong, sorry, to blow it up. And they literally blew it up. But what ended up ensuing was nothing compared to what we've seen on the streets of the United States in the last few months. right? There was no, all the China bashers were accusing the police of doing all sorts of horrific things last year, and then we saw what it was. But this was unconscionable. It made Hong Kong completely dysfunctional, and the Chinese government have had to bring in this law to restore some form of law and order. And the law, as this former prosecutor points out, is consistent with the basic law of China that the United Kingdom agreed to, because China, Hong Kong was always going to need a national security law. This is the national security law. The problem is it's overlaid with these insinuations and assertions about China that are such awful exaggerations that China is painted as pure evil, and therefore anything it does has to have an absolutely evil motive. Well,
yeah. If I may, on a lighter note, I was in Hong Kong in 2014 during the umbrella protests, and went down and interviewed people. And I was amazed that the public restrooms there in Central, that you're not in the shopping mall, the actual public restroom on the street, was open. And I thought, well, if the police really want to get rid of you guys, why don't they close the bathroom? And the protesters said, you know, no, they couldn't do that. This is Hong Kong. And, you know, they have to leave the bathrooms open. And I laughed and I said, in America, when there are the Occupy protests in Manhattan, you know, good luck finding a bathroom. They did everything possible to push people out. And the Hong Kong police, I thought, at that time in 2014, were remarkably gentler than any comparable American police force. But you know, this isn't about police brutality in the United States, which, you know, is a problem. This is about rule of law. And the fact is that China simply does not have habeas corpus. And today, Hong Kong no longer does either. If China simply wants to arrest you in Hong Kong, not tell you what you're charged with, not tell anyone you were arrested, and stick you in a prison and throw away the key until you give them or tell them whatever they want, there's nothing anyone can do, and that's Chinese rule of law. Now, that may be the rule of law in China, but that's not what the rest of us mean by rule of law.
Sorry, Salvatore. Under the national security laws that most countries have passed, in the last 20 years, post 9/11, they've all gone in that direction. There's two Australians in jail in Australia, Witness K and Witness X, I think his name is. You wouldn't even know they were there except for some strange arrangements that somehow it got out that they were there. And nobody knows that these are secret trials, etc. And this is a supposedly rule of law country, and this is all done under the umbrella of national security. And, of course, most famously, you have an Australian in Britain who's solely there because he exposed United States war crimes in Iraq. And that's what the United States is prepared to do to anybody that it chooses to, similar to the daughter of the Huawei founder in Canada. She's only been put under house arrest at America's insistence, and Canada bowed to that insistence. The Canadian Secret Intelligence Service called it a highly political act.
There is an extradition warrant out for her, and were she to be extradited to the United States, I think there's very little risk of her being put in a Guantanamo-style prison, offshore prison. If she's extradited to the United States, she'll be extradited to the United States. She'll stand trial.
There are people in Guantanamo, though, aren't there?
So Guantanamo is a terrible stain on America's rule of law. That said, habeas corpus was not applied because they were not American citizens in Guantanamo. When people were identified as American citizens, they were repatriated. And Guantanamo, of course, was extraordinarily controversial in the United States, led to congressional hearings, it led to outcry in the press, it led to all sorts of condemnation, it led to people like me writing articles to condemn America's actions in Guantanamo. And that kind of self-correction, that kind of self-correction does not happen in today's China.
Guantanamo Bay is still open.
Guantanamo Bay is still open in a bizarre legal limbo of stateless people who have nowhere to return to, but they have lawyers.
So what's the self-correction you talk about?
What is what? Sorry, self-correction? Oh, what self-correction is that Guantanamo has been largely closed. It's been exposed. The people who are in Guantanamo got lawyers. They got representation. They've had cases heard. Now, look, I'm not endorsing it as being perfect. What I'm saying is that in America, you don't disappear into a legal black hole the way you can and do in China. I don't think Hong Kongers... But Hong Kongers are Chinese citizens. It's not that, you know, I'm afraid of going to Hong Kong. If anything, I feel very secure going to Hong Kong precisely because I'm an American citizen. It's Hong Kongers who are afraid to be in Hong Kong.
Well, there's no evidence of that. They keep talking about the mass exodus. The real estate lobby in Australia hopes there's a mass exodus. So far, there hasn't been a mass exodus. And as I said, the former prosecutor, speaking on behalf of people that he knows in Hong Kong, are happy with the new law. Plenty of Hong Kong people, the majority of Hong Kong people, according to polls, just wanted the whole thing to settle down and some rule of law to return. But I just want to point out that a lot of this, again, it's all insinuation about China. There's all these assumptions people make. They seem to think they know everything about the Chinese legal system, yet they're up there. You know, I would just challenge people, whatever you think you may know about the legal system, go and do some actual deep digging and check it for yourself. Don't just take those old Cold War memes that were fed to you about how a legal system of another country works. The thing is, though, when we talk about something like habeas corpus, right, as important as that is, but as expendable as that is also in the right circumstances, as it's been shown to be, we're expressing a good principle of Western law. It is a good principle, but it's a principle of Western law. We impose onto a country like China, which has a 5,000 year history, right, that we think it should be doing things in a certain way. It says, no, we're happy doing things in this other way, thank you very much. We may not think, well, that's the best system for us, but that's fine. But I don't think we should. I think the world would be a better place if we stopped thinking that we get to decide what's the best system for them. And the issue with Hong Kong was always just the fundamental overriding issue about Hong Kong is Hong Kong is China. That's the bottom line. Whatever people might think when they talk about freedom for Hong Kong, they mean separation from China. That's an absolute impossibility. China will never tolerate that. No country would tolerate losing a place like Hong Kong, right? And China won't either. And one of the things that gets to up my nose is when we demonize a country like China, and it's always in these human rights terms, yet it's so clearly cynical. And the proof of that came out in 2017 when Rex Tillerson became a Secretary of State from outside of the system, right? A businessman who becomes Secretary of State. And some gentleman in the State Department named Brian Hook thought it would be helpful to introduce Rex to how things were done. And he wrote this now famous or an infamous memo on human rights where he said, one useful guideline for a realistic and successful foreign policy is that allies should be treated differently and better than adversaries. For this reason, we should consider human rights as an important issue in regard to US relations with China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. And then he went on to say, but countries like Saudi Arabia, which have terrible human rights abuses, we shouldn't raise it with them because they're our allies. And so this is not a matter of principle the way it's applied around the world. This is purely cynical. Human rights have been weaponized against whoever's the latest target of the Anglo-American regime change agenda.
And Saudi Arabia were buying up farmland in Australia, I think Australians would be equally alarmed.
Well,
okay, let me come in there again now, guys. Yeah, there are two more topics to cover before we finish. The first one, I want to go back to Belt and Road, because although we started to have a conversation about it, the fact of the matter is, again, this is another significant issue where people have very different points of view. You know, Victoria signed up for the Belt and Road. Other people in Australia seem much more nervous. Now, some see this as effectively a way of driving economic development to, you know, supranational. Others see it as a form of control. And then before we finish, we'll come and just touch on the media and how the media is actually interacting around China in the Australian context. But Salvatore, what about Belt and Road? What's your perspective on that?
Well, the Belt and Road, to me, remind everybody, is the is the Silk Road Economic Belt across Eurasia and the 21st century maritime Silk Road against across the Indian Ocean into the Northeast Africa and the Middle East. The Belt and Road Initiative is Xi Jinping's signature foreign policy initiative. It was, in my view, actually an accident, as he gave a pretty anodyne speech in Kazakhstan talking about the, you know, rebuilding the Silk Road of yore, and everyone latched onto it, and then over the next 6 months or so, it became China's foreign policy initiative. They knew that it sold well. It was a great trademark. That said, I don't think it's a very meaningful it's not a very meaningful term. I mean, really what it means is China will offer to underwrite or subsidize infrastructure construction or other projects, but you have to use Chinese materials and Chinese firms to do it. They will give you below market financing in exchange for political benefits. So, you know, simple things like providing a loan a little bit below market rate, and in exchange the country, or in Victoria's case perhaps the state, I don't know, signing onto it, uses Chinese terms like we are promoting win-win cooperation for a more harmonious world. And in China, these terms really matter, that to have other countries and respected leaders from other places endorsing Chinese terminology gets plastered all over the Chinese press as a way of legitimizing what China does. Now, I don't view the Belt and Road Initiative as uniquely evil. That said, I don't view it as very effective from a Chinese standpoint. I view it as mainly transactional, and frankly, you know, if I were in charge of a developing country and I was offered cheap Chinese financing for a road, honestly, I'd probably take it. On the other hand, if I were running a rich, highly developed state in a developed country, I would probably say, no thanks, we can finance our own infrastructure initiatives.
Robbie, what do you think on Belt and Road? I know think, that you've got a different view.
I think it's, I think to put air quotes around the idea of a harmonious, win-win solutions and a harmonious future, is unnecessarily cynical. I think the whole world would work better if we tried to look for that kind of grounds for cooperation. But that becomes, you know, these are important concepts to China, and it wants to show it can be win-win. China, as I said, China succeeded with a certain approach, and it's and China, there is an element of self-interest where China knows that if, especially places like Africa and Asian countries, if they actually grow, if their living standards grow in any way comparable to the growth in China's living standards, and they're there to trade with China, I mean, everyone, you can only benefit from that, right? The thing with the Belt and Road, though, it's a mistake to think it was some kind of a thought bubble in 2013. It actually, this is an idea that was being seriously talked about from the mid-1990s onwards. I know, because our organisation was promoting that idea. It was initially called, you know, just the New Silk Road or the Eurasian Land Bridge, and it evolved into something more. Xi came along and made it the centrepiece of his foreign policy.
In the early 2000s, by the way, the United States also had a New Silk Road initiative focused on Afghanistan and connecting Afghanistan to Central Asia. So everyone and their brothers had a New Silk Road.
Well, I don't know how to respond to that. All that America's achieved in Afghanistan is an 18-year quagmire war.
Yeah.
Whereas China... China is genuinely building infrastructure, and there are places, especially in Africa, where the results have been spectacular. And Ethiopia is one of those. The railway system that China has helped Ethiopia to build has been brilliant in driving economic growth in that country. And in fact, a few years ago, Ethiopia had a famine everywhere as bad as, or had a drought everywhere as bad as the early 80s, the Live Aid era. But nobody died because the infrastructure was there this time to help distribute the food adequately, thanks to their cooperation with China. The Belt and Road gets demonized as debt trap diplomacy by people like Mike Pompeo. But even, I mean, there are some of the best studies of this have been done by American institutions such as the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. There's a report in June 2020, Debt Relief with Chinese Characteristics, and pointing out just how much debt China has forgiven in those countries. It's quite extraordinary. At least $4.3 billion in the last 20 years of African debt has been cancelled by China, not just delayed, cancelled. And also the way what China does with its money is very much infrastructure focused, whereas it's not the biggest investor in Africa by far. The United States and the United Kingdom are, but its investment is in the form of infrastructure, whereas the United States and the United Kingdom's investment is in the form of mining, right, to extract raw materials. China is actually helping build infrastructure, and yes, it comes with debt, but they're prepared to be flexible on that. The Sri Lanka port is the one that's always demonized as the proof of Chinese debt trap diplomacy, whereas it was the Sri Lankan government that asked China to lease that port because they couldn't pay their debt, but the percentage of the total foreign debt of Sri Lanka they owed to China was 10%, and that was on preferential terms. It's the rest of the debt they owed to the international capital markets that was choking them, and China did them a favour, and that came with extra investment by China, and now that port is actually, because it's very well positioned, is being very successful.
So yeah, you won't hear me talking about debt trap diplomacy. In fact, in my book, American Tin Cha, I took exactly the opposite argument. I said that this is actually benefiting developing countries that at any time can cut ties with China and refuse to pay back the debt. That is when the power in a debtor relationship is with the debtor, not with the creditor. And I think that's why it's been spectacularly unsuccessful for China. That is, China has spent lots of money on the Belt and Road Initiative that has done very little to benefit China. Although they thought it would benefit China, they're fine. They have a bunch of fair weather friends who, the minute the infrastructure is built, can say, sorry, China, we don't agree with you anymore. Now, the question is, should a developed 21st century state like Victoria, however things may look to you right now in Victoria, it's still a very rich state that is able, technically and financially able to build its own infrastructure. Well, should Victoria be looking to China to be part of its, to be part of China's orbit? And frankly, I think it's so ridiculous that I laugh at it. It's hard even to have a serious discussion about Victoria joining the Belt and Road.
That's a misunderstanding of what the Belt and Road is. It's not so much for China to build infrastructure in Victoria. It's for, Australia was invited as a nation, just like the United States was. Victoria picked this up as a certain initiative by participating in the Belt and Road on an agreement, by the way, that is very loose. The agreement with China and Victoria gives China no say over Victoria whatsoever. All that is blown completely out of proportion, but it's a deal that gives Victoria a leg up in terms of trade with China and an ability to participate in some of these projects. We can offer know-how and assistance. Now, that said, I do not want to overstate, as much of an advanced first world country Australia is, I do not want to overstate our ability to build infrastructure, because by comparison to China, we have been pathetic for way too long. We used to build exceptional infrastructure, but if I can illustrate it with the last time they did a proper costing benefit analysis on the very fast train from Melbourne to Brisbane. They, under the Julia Gillard government, they said it would cost $104 billion and take 50 years to build. And when we heard that, we thought, well, maybe we should invite China in to build that project.
Yeah, well, the Australian governments can't just bulldoze your house because it's in the path of their planned high-speed rail, and that's, I think, the difference.
Well, I don't know why. Of course, they can.
They can after an extensive legal procedure.
Let's finish that conversation point there. We're running out of time. We've got 4 or 5 minutes left.
Sure, Martin.
So, just the last point to touch on before we close: the media in Australia and how they represent China and the relationship between China and Australia, I think is something we should just briefly explore, because actually this is, of course, where a lot of people get their opinions and get their views on the situation. Salvatore, you go first. What's your view in terms of the way that the media handles this relationship at the moment?
The ABC is bizarrely complacent, I think, about the threat posed by China. Now, I don't watch it a lot. That's from reading their content on the internet. I'm really shocked by it. But then I'm an opponent in general of state media. So, I don't know what to tell you about your ABC. In the private media sphere, of course, as Robbie's already suggested, Sky News is rabidly anti-China, and okay, fair enough. They have a viewpoint, and I don't disagree with their viewpoint so much as the way they state it. Other media, like the major newspapers, take a more balanced or nuanced approach on China, and it's good enough. I think Australia has had a much better China debate in the last year and a half or so than it had during the first 8 years that I was in Australia, and it's good to see that it's become much more robust and to quote Chairman Mao, let a thousand flowers bloom.
I think the media has been abysmal, including the ABC, especially the Four Corners relationship with, well, it's probably moved on to 60 Minutes now, Nick McKenzie and the nine papers. Once upon a time, you at least had a difference between the Murdoch Press and Fairfax, and now that under this new Nine arrangement, they've all every outlet just channels they conform to what the overriding foreign policy direction is, and they speak to that narrative. Can I just give an example? Nick McKenzie today, there's a handful of media personalities that are the real. They just spend all their waking moment thinking up ways to demonize China for us. Nick McKenzie's one. Chris Uhlman at Channel 9 is another. Peter Harch is another. But Nick McKenzie did this dramatic story a few weeks ago where he had special access from ASIO and the federal police to this raid on Shawkat Musliman, the New South Wales Labor Member of Parliament, over supposed foreign interference. And today they had to report that ASIO hasn't even questioned this guy. They haven't questioned this MP that they so obviously blatantly raided. And when I see that, it's just the relationship that the senior Australian journalists that have blown the whistle on the fact that there's too close a relationship between the leading media in Australia and the intelligence services, especially ASIO. And the problem with that, this was something that was an issue in the United States in the 1970s. It came out then as well, and I suspect that relation, despite that attention in the 70s, that didn't change. You're not just the media, therefore, not just close to ASIO. They're close to ASIO is part of the Five Eyes. So, in other words, they're effectively reflecting Anglo-American views on this. There's no sense of any independent scrutiny of Australian foreign policy. And so the public just get this relentless drip, 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 drip about China, and that's why you can have this dramatic change just in the space of a few years. A shift in public opinion in Australia from one that was sort of, probably evenly split to one that's now overwhelmingly hostile to China. But I said this reminds me of that 1988 paper I referenced earlier, where the one positive in that paper is the two authors pointed out how quickly when the governments decide to change things, they can turn it around. They use the example of the United States and China in the 1970s. And in 1976, opinion polls in the United States showed 3/4 of Americans were very anti-communist China. By the early 1980s, 3/4 of Americans were positive towards China. Why? Because American foreign policy changed. They decided to become friends with China. China was still a very communist country, right? But once the foreign policy changed, the whole narrative changed and the public went along with it. And that's what happened.
I think the pandas at the National Zoo probably had more to do with it.
public opinion is shaped by the media, and the media reflects the, you can say you have a free media, but the media reflects the foreign policy establishment.
Yeah. And the pandas.
don't forget the pandas, guys. Very important. Okay, well, I think we're pretty much at the end of the show tonight. I want to say thank you very much to both of you for sharing your thoughts and spending time with us. I think it's true to say that there are significant differences of opinions that we've expressed tonight, and I just want to say thank you for both being brave enough to state your position and stand by it. So Salvatore, thanks very much for you to you. You're on at the moment. So any last thoughts before I turn across to Robbie?
Robbie opened talking about John Quincy Adams, and I love to remind people, John Quincy Adams was a George Bush, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton rolled into one. He was the son of a president, a Harvard law professor, and a former Secretary of State. So while I do respect his point of view, he did represent a sort of American establishment viewpoint that not all Americans share. And I think a lot of Americans sincerely want to see a moral foreign policy in the United States that is very active out in the world and supports people out in the world and is, well, you know, adventurous, you can call it, but, you know, Americans are very proud of their involvement in World Wars I and II and very proud of their involvement in the Cold War with the Soviet Union. And I think a lot of Americans, maybe John Quincy Adams wouldn't have been one of them, are very proud for what the country is doing with regard to China today.
Thank you, Salvador. Great to have you on tonight. Robbie, your last thought?
Well, I'm a bit taken aback by that. I would hope Americans are very proud of their role in World War II. I would hope, and I know Americans are not very proud of their role in Iraq. I would hope they are aware enough to understand they shouldn't be proud of their role in Libya. These have been unmitigated disasters, the consequences of which we're still living with today, which you've glossed over, unfortunately, but that's the world in which we are shaped by, not World War II anymore. And the countries of the world who sat by and watched that happen, such as China and Russia, it forced them to take steps to defend themselves. But that said, I do think I'd like to leave on a more positive note. It would be good to have a world where it wasn't so obviously shaped by theoretical geopolitical considerations of great power competition. There is real solid ground for cooperation between countries. China, through the Belt and Road, through the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, has repeatedly reached out to the United States to invite it to participate in those things, reached out to Australia, reached out to the rest of the world. It's the United States that, for example, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, when the United States tried to ram that through, it excluded China from it. The United States is the one that's putting conditions on countries. Whereas if we drop that kind of thinking, right, focused on what we have in common as countries, yeah, every country's going to have a different system to bring to the table, but over time, the best that they have to offer will be welcomed by each other, and that's how you progress going forward. The current trajectory we're on is not that, and it's very, very dangerous, and that's why I think we have to be outspoken against it.
Well, Robbie, thank you very much for that, and thank you both for your time this evening. Interesting, very thoughtful. I've taken away a number of very interesting perspectives that I hadn't really thought about before, and I'm going to investigate more about pandas as well after this, because I think that's going to be something worth following up on. So just to close out, Ron, Nifi, Jared, Mickey, Aaron, Nico, thank you very much for your contributions tonight. Terrific, really appreciate that. Thank you for all of those who stuck with us to the end. I noticed we had a few people go, you know, I get one of these sessions, but nevertheless, a good turnout. Now, just to say that next week, the show will be back to normal insofar that we're going to be talking about household financial confidence and the latest in my analysis. I'll have the postcode and engine online. I'll also have some of the other work that I've been doing recently with regard to the trajectory in terms of the flows, all of those things. So that, I think, will be quite interesting in terms of price movements and all those other analytics too. So that's next week. So same time, same station. Thank you very much for everyone who's participated. Thank you very much to Robbie and to Salvador. Great conversation, very interesting conversation. And we'll be back next week with something else in the same mode, but hopefully a little less fraught than tonight. It's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off, wishing everybody a good evening, and take care. See you later.